Today on the 21st Show, President-elect Donald Trump and his team have pledged to make major changes to immigration policy in America, including mass deportations of migrants and prosecutions of anyone who gets in their way. He's counting on former Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Tom Homan to do the work.
If your Chicago mayor doesn't want to help, he can step aside. But if he impedes us, if he knowingly harbors and conceals an illegal alien, I will prosecute him.
Today, as we continue exploring what four more years of Trump could mean for Illinois, we'll talk about how Trump's immigration policy could work and how it can and cannot be enforced. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. As we've been doing all week, today we continue exploring what Donald Trump's return to the presidency could mean for Illinois. Among the many policy proposals the president-elect talked about while campaigning, immigration was among the most common and the most important to voters, according to polls.
On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history to get the criminals out. Today, our cities are flooded with illegal aliens. Americans are being squeezed out of the labor force and their jobs are taken.
We're going to have to seal up those borders.
We're like a garbage can for the world.
Is it your plan to deport everyone who is here illegally over the next 4 years?
Well, I think you have to do it. And it's a very tough thing to do. But you have to have, you know, you have rules, regulations, laws. They came in illegally.
Among the most important to voters, I should say. I want to clarify that. All right, we asked our texting group about this. Christopher in Brimfield said, I hope Congress will stop him and not fund his agenda. He's way out of line with his plan to deport millions of people. But John in Harvard said, any illegal immigrant, his words, especially one that has a record of lawbreaking, should be deported as soon as can be done. Certainly any economic migrant who came here by jumping the line and self-electing to break the law needs to go. If it raises the cost of construction or picking vegetables, that's fine. American workers have stagnated in large part because we've let managers and business owners offload work to 10 million illegal migrants who are taking pay raises and jobs away from Americans. Thank you, Christopher and John. What do you think about that? 800-222-9455 is the number. Do you think Trump will be able to accomplish what he promised while campaigning? And what should become of Illinois' self-designated role as a sanctuary state? 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455 is the number. All right, a little roadmap for today. Later in the show, we're going to hear from people with organizations who work directly with migrants and refugees. But we begin with two reporters who cover these topics. Adriana Cardona Magidad is the immigration reporter for WBEZ, Chicago Public Radio. Adriana, welcome to the 21st Show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Elvia Malagon, social justice and wage gap reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times. Elvia, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adriana, I'm going to begin with you. One of the first things that comes to mind when we talk about immigration in Illinois is that the state has this sanctuary status through what was called the Trust Act. Can you remind us, what does the Trust Act actually entail?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll first start kind of like by just talking about what sanctuary cities or sanctuary laws mean. There's no real like legal definition. It's an unofficial term for jurisdictions, whether it's a state, like a county or a city, that pretty much prohibits the enforcement and the collaboration from, you know, between, you know, local state officials with federal immigration authorities. So pretty much this means with the Trust Act. So in the case of Illinois, we have the Welcoming City Ordinance, and Illinois has the Trust Act. Other municipalities may have their own versions of these sanctuary laws, but in the prohibition of this collaboration, pretty much local enforcement agents cannot share any information like names and addresses of undocumented people. they can't really help or collaborate with immigration agents to pretty much kind of like run down, like you know, secure an area so that immigration agents can start doing checkups and ask people about their immigration status. So it really kind of like established this prohibition of collaboration between local law enforcement agents and immigration officials, and you know, to further kind of like, you know, I guess safeguard the rights of undocumented people, even though they don't have an immigration status. Not having an immigration status doesn't mean that you're a criminal. So it's more like a civil offense. So there's a distinction, and it doesn't mean that undocumented people are criminal. So it protects these residents.
So federal authorities can still operate. They just can't have help from local law enforcement or other government agencies. All right, but let's listen to a clip. This is former U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Tom Homan, who is set to become Trump's border czar. Here's what he said to Chicago Republicans at an event last month about enforcing Trump's immigration policy.
If your Chicago mayor doesn't want to help, he can step aside. But if he impedes us, if he knowingly harbors and conceals an illegal alien, I will prosecute him. Chicago's in trouble because your mayor sucks and your governor sucks.
Adriana, have you heard from Illinois or Chicago or any other government officials here who are worried about being prosecuted?
Like government officials being worried about being persecuted? I have not directly talked to any law enforcement official that may be afraid of this. But obviously, you know, I actually went to that event where Homan was talking about this. And, you know, I was able to see retired cops and, you know, people who support, obviously, you know, his attempts and his kind of like desire to like crack down on immigration and deport a lot of people. I will say that not, you know, based on just even past experiences with, you know, like just having unofficial conversations with police officers here in Chicago, that you know, like it runs the gamut. Like there are, you know, officials who may feel that they would like to pursue something like this, but obviously, like there are also, you know, officers out there who are more concerned about public safety in the communities.
Yeah. Elvia Malagón, we talk about all this knowing that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has increased the number of people it's monitoring since 2019. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's correct. We did a story in the fall about how the Chicago field office, so that includes people, you know, that are living in Chicago, Illinois, but also some of the surrounding states, ICE is monitoring electronically immigrants there the most it has in the past 5 years. And it grew really fast from in 2019, it was just under 3,000 people that were part of these programs. And by last year, 2024, the number had increased to more than 19,000 immigrants that were under these type of programs. And when we talk about monitoring, you know, it's kind of like your traditional ankle monitor that one might have seen or is depicted in the movies, but it's also different kinds of technology. For example, some people have an app on their phone that they have to take a selfie of every so often to ensure compliance with ICE. So we definitely know that right now there are more people being monitored. And some people that I spoke to said one of the reasons may have been, of course, because of the coronavirus pandemic and everything that happened, but also because of the passage of the Illinois Forward Act, which stopped local jails from contracting with federal officials to detain those who face deportation orders. So that may also be leading to this increase.
So immigration has really gone on a significant decline over the past half year. Adriana, maybe you can just remind us why that happened. There's all this focus on illegal immigration during the campaign, but that's really taken a nosedive. What changed?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, during the summer, I think earlier in the summer, if I remember correctly, President Biden issued another executive order, pretty much really putting control, like a tight control over, like the people who could actually cross and just, claim or further apply for political asylum. So he established limitations on the number of people that could be crossing every day. But even before that, we saw an increase, an exponential increase, but then that number started to decrease even before this executive order. And that could be for a variety of reasons. I mean, migrants or people who are, coming from South America are exposing themselves to an extremely dangerous journey. They're crossing the Darien Gap is extremely dangerous. Then after that, like just several borders. And then when they get here to the United States and even, to cities in the Midwest, including Chicago, they experience a lot of hardships. And in a way, this decline, even before this executive order, could have been because people, like the word kind of like spread that you can make this really hard journey, but things aren't as rosy as you might think once you get to your final destination. And so, and people may be better off staying back where they were initially. So there are, in my own, reporting and talking to people, I've, encountered kind of like these two, situations happening around that time, like the spring and early summer of 2024.
Yeah, you mentioned the Darien Gap. The story has stuck with me for more than 4 years now. People should Google PBS NewsHour Darien Gap and just see what that is like, that journey is actually like. Aaliyah, as part of your reporting, you looked at what immigration is like in other countries. We just heard Adriana say how it's not always as rosy as maybe people had expected when they come to America. You compared to what the experience of a migrant is like in Toronto, Canada, because it's kind of a similar city to Chicago. Talk about that story and how that compares.
Yeah, last year we spent 2 weeks in Toronto, Canada, and we were really trying to see how immigration differs there. Canada, is kind of known as like the friendlier country. That's kind of like the stereotype. So we wanted to really dig into what that actually means for immigrants. We talked to a couple different types of immigrants. We certainly did talk to some who are seeking asylum there as well. It's a little bit of a different process. But they were able, while their cases were pending, they were able to get work permits and some type of help from the government. It was kind of limited and tied to like economic means. So once you got a job, you maybe weren't eligible for that type of help. But we also talked to people. So we met up with a couple who actually had lived in the Milwaukee area before they decided to move to Toronto. And one of the reasons why they did was because one of them, he did have DACA protections, but even after marrying a US citizen, he was basically denied the ability to adjust his status. He was never able to get anything beyond DACA, which is kind of temporary, and he was getting very nervous because this was actually under President Donald Trump's first presidential term. And so they decided to do express entry, which is a system for economic migrants or economic immigrants to go to Canada. And him and his husband were able to go to Toronto. And I interviewed them, and the person who had DACA protections, he actually became a Canadian citizen. So he's been able to vote in Canada, and he also just talked about how he felt a sense of shift in like his own mental health and how he felt, and he didn't really realize the level of stress that he was carrying by, trying to navigate the system in the US versus in Canada. They did hire a lawyer to navigate that system, but they thought they could have probably done it on their own. Just from, kind of being, having careers, but not legal experts at all, but because the system was so easy to navigate, they probably could have done it on their own. So it definitely, even though Canada is affected by the sentiments of the US, and we've seen some restrictions in Canada, for example, of like student visas, it still seems like it is a different way and a different perspective. One thing I heard a lot in Canada was they viewed a lot of immigrants as being a bit of a necessity to fill, like, for example, population declines, or to fill the hole for certain sectors that were losing workers or didn't have enough workers. So it is a different shift than what we hear here.
Yeah, an actual path to citizenship. Well, Elvia, we're coming to the end of our time together. What are you going to be looking out for in the next 4 years, or maybe even the next 4 weeks, as you're covering this issue?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty that people are trying to navigate. I think one of the things is we kind of expect that the priorities for who ICE targets will change and probably expand to include more people than maybe ICE had targeted in the past. I think here in Chicago and definitely in Illinois, you know, there aren't any like private large-scale detention centers. The local jails don't have contracts with federal agents. So that kind of means if someone is detained, they might end up in a different state or in a facility elsewhere in the country. So I think trying to see how that plays out for folks will be definitely something that we want to follow. I think, as you mentioned, the tension between local officials here and officials on the federal level, you know, Governor J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson have in the past couple of weeks reiterated their support for immigrants, but I think it'll be key to see what ends up happening. And also, we also in
Briefly,
the
yeah.
last Trump administration, we saw a reduction in the amount of refugees allowed into the country. So
Ah,
we'll
we'll stay.
certainly be looking for
Yeah.
that.
And I'll tell you, listeners, stay tuned. We're going to be talking about that at the end of the show today. Elvia Malagón and Adriana Cardona Maguidad, thank you both so much for being with us today on the 21st show.
Thank you
Thank
so
you.
much.
More to come. We're going to continue on this topic. We're going to turn now to some advocates who work with migrants. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. This entire week, we've been exploring what to expect under 4 more years of a Trump administration, and specifically what it could mean in Illinois. Today, we're focusing on immigration. Lloyd in Danville sent us a text message, said, "I believe that this administration will not be as successful as planned because of existing policies to deport immigrants." And we have this voicemail.
Yes, my name is Liam, and I live in Springfield, Illinois, and I am an immigrant to the United States. And as we know that the undocumented are involved in all sorts of industry in the United States, including construction, taking care of the elderly, holding the hotel industry, picking fruit and vegetables, and other industries that I heck have not even thought of. And I believe what Trump is going to do is he's going to go after Democratic states, and he's going to try to deport the undocumented in the Democratic states to get even.
You can let us know what you thought by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. What do you think of President-elect Trump's stated immigration policies? How many people do you think will have been deported by this time next year, as he says he's going to do? And as a self-appointed sanctuary state, what role does Illinois have in this conversation? Again, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We turn now to people who work directly with migrants. Danielle DeWinter is legal director for the Immigration Project. Danielle, welcome to the 21st show.
Thank you. Good
morning. Good morning. And Lawrence Benito is director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Lawrence, welcome back to the show to you.
Thank you for having me.
Lawrence, as we learned, or I should say, as you learned, Trump won the election. What were some of your first reactions, your immediate concerns with regard to these topics?
Well, the campaign was pretty obvious. in that and the people that he's the president-elect has considered for key roles in the administration around a mass deportation, you know, agenda, which we obviously reject as an organization, because, you know, we believe that immigrants have come and continue to come for the same reasons that earlier generations have, and that's a shot at a better life for themselves and their families.
What has the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, you and your colleagues there, what have you been doing to sort of prepare for a second Trump administration?
Sure. Our coalition is a coalition of about 100 organizations across the state of Illinois that has worked to get together to advocate for pro-immigrant policies at the federal, state, and local levels. And so when we heard about the incoming administration's plans for, you know, mass deportations, we've been working to train local leaders and organizations in Know Your Rights, that folks, regardless of status, are afforded, you know, due process and their day in courts. And so, you know, we've been training people on what their rights are and what they can do in the event of raids and immigration enforcement.
Danielle DeWinter with the Immigration Project. Same questions to you. What was your sort of top line reaction, and what have you been doing to sort of prepare for the Trump administration?
Yes, you know, obviously our team and many of the immigrants that we serve were scared, especially coming off of what happened in the previous administration. In the meantime, our staff has been trying to prioritize serving those who we assume and, you know, likely know that Trump's administration 2.0 will target, given the first go around. So trying to push a lot of individuals who are currently DACA holders, trying to push their applications through prior to the administration, trying to get cases in removal closed or dismissed or administratively closed to kind of protect their those individuals' rights before any changes are happening.
What does that mean, cases in removal?
Yeah, so individuals who are currently fighting their case to remain in the United States in immigration court oftentimes have administrative opportunities such as, you know, instead of fighting their case in court, they may have opportunities to apply affirmatively for other types of relief through United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. That's extremely likely for kids who are applying for asylum or folks who are applying for asylum who were able to file ahead of time before their case was placed in immigration court, and survivors of trauma. So it's like they have two cases kind of moving alongside parallel, one affirmatively and then one in immigration court. And oftentimes we can try to get those cases terminated in immigration court to allow due process to happen on the affirmative case.
So, Danielle, have people been reaching out to you for help with, I mean, are people scared? What are you hearing from your clients?
Oh, yes, we're hearing a lot of fear, unfortunately. So we're hearing, you know, our younger clients and families fearing that there will be a divide between them. Kids coming home from school not knowing if their parents are going to be there under the new administration, given the expanse of and fear around detention and mass deportations. We're hearing a lot of DACA individuals being fearful that they're going to be pulled away from their home that they've known for years and years and have been active members of their community. And then from the nonprofit side, even in legal aids, even staff are concerned about what is this going to mean for us, and what are we going to be targeted for helping and doing the work that we're currently doing.
Lawrence, let me ask you about another issue that's come up just in the past few weeks, and that is visas, particularly H-1B visas. Is there anxiety among H-1B visa holders right now? How are you and your coalition members thinking about that?
Well, you know, I don't think that even within the Republican Party, there is consensus about how they want to approach this. In fact, there's been a strife around, you know, allowing, you know, skilled workers in at the same time that, you know, there's competition or perceived competition with American workers. So even within Trump's leadership team, there has been some disagreement about how they're going to move forward, you know, on that issue. You know, we believe you can, no matter how big of a wall that you put up, people are going to continue to come here if they're trying to, you know, seek safety or a better life from, you know, where they're living. And so I think as a country, we need to figure out our values, but also, you know, the needs of this country and the reality that immigration has had a long part of our history as a country, and we'll continue to do so.
Danielle, let me ask you about, we talked a little earlier in the show about the idea that Illinois is a sanctuary state. It's got the Trust Act. Talk about the disconnect between how Illinois can and cannot comply with federal immigration law, and, you know, how this enforcement of early Trump administration, if it happens, might look differently here versus surrounding states.
Yes, absolutely. So the Trust Act is wonderful, and the expansions that Governor Pritzker has put into place is great, and trying to create a welcoming and kind feeling towards immigrants amongst populations and communities. But unfortunately, it's not going to stop ICE from entering into our state and taking action. So, you know, ICE agents are still going to be able to come in. They're going to be able to come and, you know, detain individuals. And even though we don't have detention centers in the state of Illinois, they're going to be detained in other states. You know, Boone is a big one in Indiana. There's a few in Indiana. And they're overpopulated, and they're full, and it's going to continue to happen. What is great about the state of Illinois is, like our previous your previous guests have articulated, is that it does limit the types of communication and the direct assistance our law enforcement agencies can provide to ICE. So, you know, it does prohibit sharing of the private information. It does prohibit holding an individual in custody for the sole purpose of an immigration detainer, but it will not prevent federal warrants. It will not prevent communication between law enforcement agencies and ICE. And again, the biggest thing is it will not prevent individuals being detained.
Lawrence, I want to read part of a text we got from Tom in Elburn, who says, I personally don't care if Illinois is a so-called sanctuary state or not. The law states that if you are here illegally, you can be deported. I don't understand where the outright defiance of this law comes from. Lawrence, do you think there's been a shift in the sort of general public in the way people respond to immigrants?
You know, I don't know if it's a shift. I think there's definitely been a lot of attention about in the last, you know, 2 years, particularly because of the buses coming from Texas. And we know that was a political ploy by the governor to sow, you know, divisions in advance of, you know, Chicago hosting the Democratic National Convention. And to some extent that was, you know, successful. But inside of that, we saw the humanity of people of all faiths and communities, you know, come together because they understood the humanitarian crisis that was created. And so I know that there has been and historically been, you know, pushback about, you know, the waves of immigration to this country, but it has been part of our history. And so, yes, we need to do better at addressing the needs of communities that have been here. But at the same time, our country needs immigration. And so, you know, balancing that, because I think when you uncover, you know, peel back the layers of the onion here, people's frustrations are coming from the belief that government is not working for them, and the partisanship needs to stop. The Trump administration has an opportunity. Republicans will control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And so now they have an opportunity to pass, you know, immigration laws and to solve this problem. And so if that's what the majority of Americans, thought when they cast the vote, now it's time to govern. Let's see what they can do with the power that they have. Stop scapegoating, immigrants, and fix the problem.
I'm trying to remember, Lawrence, if you were in the room, it was a Senate committee room. There was a news conference. This is late 2012, right after the election. Mitt Romney had lost. This was even before the so-called autopsy. And it was Jim Edgar, Judy Bart Topinka, Republican senators and Democrats. And this was about the temporary visitor driver's licenses. And you think, just think of where the Republican side of the aisle in particular has come in the 13 years since then. Just how do you think about that? Reflect on that.
Yeah, I was in that room, and after that election, I got, calls from both Republican leaders in the State House after that election saying, "What can we do, to get right with the immigrant community?" Because at that time they called it the sleeping giant of the power of the Latino and immigrant vote. And so, this is like the pendulum shifts right back and forth. And right now it's the punching bag. But then, come midterm elections, people want, folks' votes. I think there's a growing realization that the status quo is not working, for anyone. Both parties need to figure out how they are going to work with immigrant communities if they do want, their vote in addition to their labor. We're a nonpartisan organization. We will work with both parties that, work to actually address the underlying, issues. And so, this scapegoating, this blaming, it's just not going to be tolerated. And not only that, it's just not helpful to actually creating an environment that solves problems for real people. And I think that's what people have a desire to do, because the vast majority of people understand immigrants come here looking for a better job for themselves, their families, working hard. They know that a lot is at stake. Going home is not an option. And so I just don't fall into the trap of, everything that was said during the campaign trail, because it just does not play out in real life.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And we've only got a couple of minutes left in our time together. But Danielle, let me ask you about that. 8 years ago, we were going to have a wall from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico. And, Mexico was going to pay for it. Obviously, that did not pan out the way it was pitched on the campaign trail. How do you think about campaign rhetoric versus what could really happen in the, first 100 days, first 100 hours? What's ahead?
Yeah, I think that, as an immigration advocate, I'm planning for the worst and hoping for the best. Lawrence is 100% right. Not everything is going to come through, but the reality is for advocates is a lot of changes are likely to happen. And a lot of those changes, it's almost change fatigue, right? So it's going to be undoing things that we are currently doing under the Biden administration. And it's even if it's small and minor, such as do we have to check every box on an application, those changes are going to be taxing both on the immigrant community as well as advocates. But I would foresee some changes certainly rolling back on in regards to priorities for deportation. We're seeing that already now with some of the votes that are happening currently. I would I expect to see some changes in regards to DACA early on, just because those were in place during the previous administration. So from an our office standpoint, we are preparing for what changes were made during the Trump 1.0, and expecting those changes to happen very quickly in the first 100 days in 2.0, and then we will go from there. Overall, we're certainly expecting to see a lot more individuals being detained, and a lot more removal defense, immigration court advocacy needed.
Danielle DeWinter is legal director at the Immigration Project. Lawrence Benito is executive director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Danielle, Lawrence, thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up after the break, we are going to be talking specifically about refugees through the lens of Syria, although obviously there are more refugees than from Syria here in Illinois. If you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Before we go to break, I also want to mention you can now find the 21st Show on YouTube by searching for our producing station, Illinois Public Media. Again, search Illinois Public Media on YouTube and listen to the 21st Show there. More to come after a break. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our week-long series, Four More Years, exploring what we might expect from the second Trump administration. Today we've been focusing on immigration, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about refugees. The country of Syria had been in a civil war since 2011 under the rule of Bashar al-Assad until his government collapsed late last year and he fled to Russia. During that time, the U.S. took in about 50,000 refugees from Syria. President Trump, during his first term, halted issuing visas in six mainly Muslim countries, including Syria. His stated reason for what was often referred to as a Muslim ban was keeping terrorists out of the U.S. Now, as we have a new Trump administration upon us, a new Syria is emerging as well. And for all of Trump's fantasizing about conquering or acquiring Greenland and Canada, the reality of what's happening in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East are likely to be among the long list of significant foreign policy issues he'll have no choice but to deal with. And this raises the question of what this could mean for Syrian refugees now and in the future. Joining us is Maya Atassi, co-executive director of the Syrian Community Network. Maya, thanks for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Can we begin? Just tell us a little bit about your relationship to Syria.
My personal relationship? I'm a first-generation daughter of a Syrian-American immigrant. My dad came in the late 70s, early 80s. My mom followed soon after that. I was born and raised here, but I visited Syria as a child. And kind of throughout my young adulthood, I haven't been there since 2009. So obviously, it's a personal connection that for a while felt really starting to feel very distant in terms of identifying with Syria as a homeland or a place that I could realistically envision going back to. But obviously, since the events of December, early December, that has changed.
How did you and your family react to the fall of Assad?
I think in terms of talking to both family, friends, clients, my colleagues that work here that were resettled here in the U.S. from Syria as refugees themselves, I think everyone can probably tell you that it's a mixture of relief that the events sort of came about as quickly and as peacefully as they did, in contrast to obviously what we had seen initially when people chose to rise up against the Assad regime. That was obviously met with a lot of brutal violence, thus the resulting exodus of people from the country into neighboring countries. Oftentimes they had already spent a year or many months displaced within Syria before they decided to leave. And then eventually the movement of those individuals, who many of whom are still in those neighboring countries of Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, to Europe, the United States, Canada, being resettled as refugees and attempting to begin lives sort of out of the trough of everything that they'd experienced. The fact that things kind of came about both as quickly and as relatively peacefully as they did, I think people are still sort of, there's a lot of joy, but there's also belief and shock at the same time. I think I've heard so many people say, I still can't even pinch myself to even wonder if it's still true or that it's happened.
Yeah. So, okay, you mentioned refugees. Syrians have been through a lot since the Arab Spring, 2011. Europe, America. Let's focus on America. Obviously, the movement of refugees began during the Obama administration. How did that start? How was that handled at the beginning?
So the United States has had the Federal Refugee Resettlement Program for many years. And so anytime there's any sort of rise in the number of people living there, whether it's through conflict or war, like a civil war, oftentimes famine related to climate change within, that causes a number of people to leave and flee. And so whenever you have sort of those situations taking place around the world, You know, the UN generally tries to set up in the neighboring countries that border those countries because they expect that there's going to be an inflow. It's to both help those individuals, but also to help the infrastructure of the country that is, quote unquote, hosting them in the interim. And then through that, the United Nations Commission of Refugee, they identify individuals or families to potentially qualify for resettlement in other countries, whether it's Europe, Canada, or the United States. Specifically with how the process works for the United States, they go through a vetting process, background checks, as well as, you know, various numbers of interviews. The process can take up to 2 to 3 years. And then finally, the approval comes to the State Department and they determine whether the person or family are eligible in terms of being resettled in the United States. And then on the ground here in the U.S., there's voluntary organizations that operate at the national level, and they have satellite offices throughout the United States. And then it's a cooperation between the federal government as well as the state government to resettle those refugees and also fund the organizations that will provide the initial what they call reception and placement services for those first 90 days.
Okay, let me take a moment to reintroduce this conversation. And I should say, Maya, your sound's a little muffled, so I think we're going to try and connect with you by phone. But let me tell listeners, or remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are continuing our week-long series on 4 more years of the Trump administration, all the different policies and how it could affect us. We began the week by talking about the federal workforce. We talked about education funding, Medicaid funding. A huge amount of money comes to the states through that. We talked about reproductive health care, abortion, and gender care. And today we are focusing on immigration. My guest for the last part of the show is Maya Atassi, who is co-executive director of the Syrian Community Network. If you want to join us for this part of the show, if you have a question about immigration policy, specifically as it relates to refugees, you can give us a call at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. All right, Maya, we were just talking about, you know, how the refugee process worked. What changed when Trump was in office for that?
So initially when Trump took office back in 2016, immediately one of the first things that he did was enact what you referred to earlier as sort of the Muslim travel ban. So obviously identifying Syria as a country that was sort of persona non grata in terms of granting visas, also immigrant-related visas, but also by extension that also because there had been so much rhetoric around refugees and refugees coming from Syria, that also by nature impacted the number of refugees that could be resettled in Syria from Syria in the United States. In addition, one thing that the president does have control over that does not need to be operated within the jurisdiction of like legislative process or passing a law is that they set the determination for the number of refugees resettled in the United States in a given year. So basically, President Obama, by comparison, and then had set his cap at 100,000 in 2016 in the last year of his presidency. He got pretty close, if not to achieving that number. By contrast, President Trump's numbers were greatly diminished. And on top of that, the number of refugees that were in actuality resettled in the United States did not even meet that number. So, you know, we can talk about the things that we're fearful of the Trump administration doing, but there are actual things that he does have power to do just when the sign of a pen, as opposed to having to go through to Congress and pass a law. Some of those things, such as revoking citizenship that people have mentioned that they're fearful of, those require laws to be changed and are going to be less likely just because of the arduous process involved. But in terms of the things that he does have the ability to do and to have a greater impact, for example, the number of refugees being resettled is something that he can immediately make a decision on day one with regards to. And so obviously, you know, we have a number of individuals from Syria still waiting, who are still waiting to be processed, even from the last Trump administration, that are still in those neighboring countries and have sort of been waiting in limbo to find out if they will be resettled in the United States. So they're still, once again, facing a waiting game. And then you obviously have conflicts all throughout the world. You have, you know, what's going on in Ukraine, and you have all these other areas where there are individuals that are fleeing their home country because of circumstances beyond their control that are potentially going to also be stuck in this limbo process potentially for the next 4 years.
You mentioned people waiting since the first Trump administration. There has been a different administration in Washington the last 4 years. How would you rate how Biden has been with on this issue as compared with Trump and maybe even Obama?
So specifically with how the Biden administration chose to handle refugee resettlement, he set his cap even higher than Obama. He set his cap at 125,000. We didn't necessarily always meet that goal just because a lot of the resettlement organizations doing the work on the ground had really been very much diminished by the changes that the Trump administration had. So a lot of the resettlement organizations rely on federal funding dollars that are calculated based on the number of each individual that they resettle. And so obviously when you completely decimate that number and decrease that number, that funding is also decreased. So a lot of organizations, some shut their doors and weren't doing any refugee resettlement work. Some had to really restructure, let go of a lot of staff. Obviously during the Biden administration, that process resumed. So families were continuing to be resettled. You saw resettlements kind of numbers pick up as much more dramatically by between 2020 and 2021 once the new administration took over. But at the same time, they were being met with an infrastructure that had been so weakened by the prior administration. So those organizations are still playing catch up now and are potentially facing the same sort of impact with the incoming administration.
You know, a few years ago, we spoke with an author, Edward Curtis, who had this book, Muslims of the Heartland, How Syrian Immigrants Made a Home in the American Midwest. And he talked about how, you know, there have been long, like decades of Syrian communities here. How has assimilation or adaptation or whatever you choose the word for it gone for the people who have come here?
So there were several waves. Obviously, speaking from personal experience, there were several waves of Syrians who came. There's sort of this existing diaspora community that has existed because, you know, we talk about Bashar Assad's regime, but there's also Assad the father who has been in power prior to that. So there was a large exodus of individuals from Syria in the late 70s, early 80s due to, again, also, you know, targeting by the previous regime of individuals so that, you know, individuals who had the capacity to send their sons and their daughters out of the country because they identified that there was lack of a better opportunity in Syria. They were able to do that. And so many of those people, you know, you have people like my parents, you have, you know, they are now part and parcel of the American fabric of society. They're doctors, engineers, attorneys, business owners. And so they very much identify with the United States as their homeland, just as much as Syria. And then you obviously have the newer wave of refugees that were resettled in the last 10 years, who are, you know, there's the earlier wave of 2015 who have become U.S. citizens. Their children are now attending schools here. Probably they're more struggling with making sure that their children learn Arabic as much as the English that they've now picked up since they've been here. And then you have the newer wave of individuals who arrived within the last 3 to 4 years who, again, like I said, had this limbo experience waiting in the neighboring countries where children are not always being allowed to attend school sometimes by that neighboring country. So you have children who maybe left Syria when they were too young to even be enrolled in school. They sat in this neighboring country for almost a decade, sort of waiting for their opportunity to be resettlement. Meanwhile, the country that was hosting them did not allow them, either because they had to pay to enroll in school or because there was a policy against allowing individuals from Syria to enroll in the public school systems in those countries. And then they come and they're resettled in the United States, where age-wise, they might be expected to be in high school, but they've never really had any formal learning themselves in either their native language, Arabic, or in English. So, you know, it's sort of everybody, you have to decide, kind of see where the spectrum of their timeline is and what their experience is. But all of them obviously recognize that there's a possible opportunity. There's safety, obviously. That's the main hope. I mean, obviously, no one chooses to go through that experience. You know, I think that's similar to people who choose to come and go through the arduous journey of crossing the border in the southern United States. There's no one goes through that because they choose to or because they have a desire to. It's only because they feel like they have no other option, really, than to undertake that journey to seek safety and sanctity for their families.
Maya Atassi is co-executive director of the Syrian Community Network. Maya, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
And that's all the time we have for our show today. Coming up tomorrow, this is an ominous time for public broadcasting. We're going to talk about how President-elect Trump's second term could bring big changes for your favorite NPR or PBS station or program. The final installment for now in our series on four more years of the Trump administration. That's coming up tomorrow. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.